This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. With more than 800 wins and two national championships, Dean Smith is revered as one of the best coaches in college basketball. But when Dean Smith arrived at UNC Chapel Hill in the 1950s, he found the town's racial segregation deeply disturbing. So Smith got to work promoting civil rights in this area. His first objective was integrating the basketball team. In 1967, Smith was able to break the racial barrier and recruit Charlie Scott. Scott was the first African-American scholarship athlete at UNC. In his new book, sports writer Art Chansky tells the story of Dean Smith, Charlie Scott, and civil rights in Chapel Hill. It's called Game Changers. Art reads at Barnes & Noble in Greensboro on Saturday, and first he joins me. Art Chansky, welcome back. Good to have you here.
Frank, always great to be with you.
Dean Smith, lots of stories of well-known, revered college basketball. What attracted you to this particular story, this aspect of his coaching?
Well, it's really funny. Most of the guys on that 67 freshman team were contemporaries of mine, and there was a strange symmetry of that team. There were five scholarship players: Charlie Scott, Eddie Fogler, Jim Delaney, Gray Whitehead, and Al Armour. And there were five walk-ons, all of whom Dean Smith knew because they had attended his basketball camps over the summer. So he knew them, he knew their families, and he knew that they all played against or with integrated teams during their high school career. And then there were five more head scholars, which at the time was the highest, most prestigious.
Five more head scholars on the team?
On the team, yeah. And this team was coached by Larry Brown, who was a very tough coach, and it bonded them together, and they had reunions over the years. And at one of the reunions, a couple of the Moorheads said, well, how did five of us get on this one team together, you know? And Fogler, who's a buddy of mine, said, well, call Chansky. He's a writer. He'll look it up. Maybe you can get an internet column out of it. So I called Chuck Lovelace, who is now the executive director of the Moorhead Kane Foundation. I told him about it, and he said, I'll do some research. And so he said, call me a week later, and said, I got the answer, but you got to come to my office. So I went there with Harold Pollard, who's a physician in Winston-Salem, one of the Moorheads, and Bob Bodie, who's a lawyer in Raleigh, one of the Moorheads. And he said, no, not even close. There's been periodic Moorheads all over the athletic department, but never this many on one team and never from the same class. And so we all looked at each other and we went, Dean Smith. And it was a way for Dean Smith, as he was a control freak, you know, he wanted to maneuver and manipulate the environment around Charlie Scott to create the best odds for him to have a successful stay, because if Charlie Scott didn't make it, it would have been like Duke's first player didn't make it, C.B. Claiborne. He was very unhappy, and it was 10 years before they signed Gene Banks. So Charlie Scott making it was very important. And so when I got into it, I found out, well, it's, you know, why was it so difficult for Charlie? And a lot of it had to do with the racial divide on the campus. There were only 54 blacks when Charlie enrolled at Carolina. And it was just coming off of the civil rights movement. And with Mark Simpson Voss, the executive editor at UNC Press, he said, well, you've got to tell the whole story, why the environment was this way. And that's how we went back and got into the civil rights aspect of it. Go ahead.
Well, I'm going to ask you about Dean Smith. Take us back and why he is so interested in A, integrating the team, and then B, making sure it's a success. What is his interest in this? Maybe you should sort of lay out the racial climate that he found when he comes to Chapel Hill.
Well, he thought it was one of these great southern college towns with the magnolias blooming and all that kind of stuff. But, he soon found out that there was an undercurrent, racial undercurrent, that made its way into the churches, too, because the Reverend Charlie Jones at the Chapel Hill Presbyterian Church had been having inclusionary congregation since the 1940s that Dr. Frank Porter Graham went to. And he had invited all races, ages, everybody there. And Charlie Jones was a very divisive person in town. And Robert Seymour came, and his goal was to set up a breakaway from the Chapel Hill Baptist Church and start what became Binkley Baptist. And he wanted an inclusionary congregation, too. And Dean Smith became very friendly with Robert Seymour, and he found out about this undercurrent and this divide. And athletics often covered it up. You know, remember Frank McGuire won the national championship in 1957 with an all-white team, and it was a tremendous bonding for the town and the university. So it covers up a lot of the unhappiness that was going on. But Dean found that he refused to join the Chapel Hill Country Club until they admitted a black member.
So clearly he's a guy who comes at this with a notion of civil rights and opening things up, but he's also, you know, again, living in Frank McGuire's shadow. He was a guy who did succeed, and he understands the climate. How did he operate? Because I think your book illustrates the caution and the cleverness, the canniness with which he sort of opened this. And remember, he's a basketball player. He's not a civil rights leader, right, but he's a pretty smart guy.
Yeah, he was what I call a careful crusader in those days, because his job was on the line all the time. He was an unpopular choice as the coach. Bill Aycock, the chancellor, promoted Dean because he liked his character. He thought that he would calm the team down. You know, there were a lot of fights back then. He wanted a more representative team of the university. And Dean came to Chapel Hill with the DNA because his father had integrated high school basketball in Kansas back in the 30s. And Dean was a young boy at that time, but he grew up and watched his father deal with the pushback for the black players. And he had it in his mind that it was time for whenever he coached a college team, it was time for him to integrate it too.
Now, Dean was the assistant coach under Frank McGuire. Do we have any indication that Dean was pushing McGuire to integrate the team?
Well, yeah, and it's interesting. When Robert Seymour said,
he's the pastor of Binkley,
yeah,
right?
The Reverend, yeah, the pastor of Binkley. He said, make it your church missionary work, but integrate. And the day that Dean got the job, Seymour called him and said, now you can do it. Well, Dean had gone to McGuire in the past, and McGuire had said he had tried to recruit Wilt Chamberlain out of Overbrook High School in Philadelphia, but Wilt didn't have the minimum ACC score required by for a scholarship then, and he really didn't have the academic record to get into Carolina, so he went to Kansas. But, you know, the idea that bringing a black to the South, McGuire had a guy named Solly Walker at St. John's, and St. John's, on its way to playing Kansas, where Dean Smith was a reserve in 1952 in Seattle, they went to Raleigh, and they beat Adolph Rupp, all-white Kentucky, in the Sweet 16, and they beat Everett Case, an all-white NC State, to get to the Final Four. And Solly Walker, they made him eat in the boiler room. They made him sleep some other place, and McGuire was furious. He was furious. And so he was reticent about bringing a black into the South because he didn't want one of his players to go through what Solly Walker went through.
So tell us about this, because we do know, part of Dean Smith's legacy is this kind of civil rights aspect to his coaching and the way he acted. But there's some mythology around it, too. The story of Dean Smith and Bob Seymour going to the Pines in Chapel Hill. Straighten that one out.
Well, that's one of the, you know, that's one of the biggest myths in the book. You know, Robert Seymour said to Dean Smith, who was an assistant coach in 1959, it's time that we start to try and integrate, and not we meaning Dean, but he said it's time for Binkley Baptist to get involved. And there were 30 closed businesses in Chapel Hill at that time, 19 were restaurants. And he said, I'm going to bring a black theology student to the Pines, and if you come with me, I think they'll seat us because they know you as an assistant coach. And sure enough, they went there, and Leroy and Agnes Merritt seated Dean and Reverend Seymour and the black theology student. They served them, and that was it. But they didn't serve them because they were opening up the restaurant. They served them because they knew Dean would go back and tell Frank McGuire, and McGuire would have pulled all of his business out of the Pines. The Tar Heels on the McGuire ate all of their pregame meals for home games and the local road games at the Pines. Hundreds, maybe thousands of dollars of business the Pines would have lost because McGuire would have reacted to that. And the reason it's a myth, Frank, is because from that incident in 1959 through the Civil Rights Act passing in 1964, the Pines was one of the most heavily protested and picketed restaurants in Chapel Hill. They never served another black until 1964. And a fellow named David McReynolds came down from New York. A lot of outsiders would come down and see what was going on. And he was in that one of the protests and spent the night in jail in Chapel Hill and went back to New York and wrote a piece in the Village Voice about it and really blasted Chapel Hill for being not exactly what everybody thinks.
Well, that's it. So the myth was that episode, which did happen, the three of them did go to that restaurant, that opened it up. It didn't.
That's
the point. It was a nice moment for, but it was only a one-time deal. Tell us more about Charlie Scott and how he ended up at UNC.
Well, Charlie came from a broken home in Harlem. His parents were divorced. His mother his mother kept his three older sisters. Charlie went with his father, who was an alcoholic, a cab driver. And Charlie was basically, you know, he was as close to homeless as you could be, you know. But he was, a lot of people were looking out for him. He did go to school, and he was playing basketball on the schoolyards. And a teacher recognized how smart he was and asked him to take the standardized test in New York City that all 8th and 9th graders could take. And if you were in those days, you had to be in the top 800, you could get into one of these privatized high schools. There were 9 of them in New York. They would sort of like magnet schools as we know them. And if you passed that test, that meant that you would be trained. You had the capability to get into college. You would be trained during one of these high schools. So Charlie took the test and he passed it, and he went to Peter Stuyvesant High School. Meanwhile, so they were telling him, you can go to college, but, you know, Charlie's saying, college, nobody from my family ever went to college. Where would I go? How would I pay for it? You know, it was, all these things were ruminating at the time, but he was starting to idolize and then being a pretty good basketball player on the schoolyard. And when he would go to these games, Frank, the players weren't always the same. Some would go, some were not there, and some would disappear, and he would ask them where, and the coaches would say, well, they're going away to prep schools to get a college scholarship. And Charlie said, which one? He said, well, the GOAT, Earl Mangold, who was one of the greatest playground players in New York, went to this place called Lorenberg Institute. They said it's either in North Carolina or South Carolina. We're not sure where it is. So Charlie asked them to do some research on it, and they came back with Frank McDuffie as the basketball coach and the headmaster. And Charlie Scott, so self-sufficient, you know, always in survival mode, and even later in life, he was always surrounded, very cautious about things. He went and wrote a letter to McDuffie and had this two AAU coaches write a letter to McDuffie, and he went and he got his transcript from his 9th grade at Stuyvesant and applied to Lorenberg, just sent him a letter. And he waited the entire summer of 1963 to hear from Frank McDuffie. And he got in. He said, we'll give you X number of scholarship dollars to go to this office in New York and that office in New York and another office in New York, and you'll get the rest of the money. So Charlie Scott, all by himself with his one little suitcase with all of his earthly possessions, got on a bus. And the bus stopped in Philadelphia and Baltimore and Washington, Raleigh, Durham, and Lorenberg, North Carolina. And why did the bus stop in Lorenberg? Because it had been stopping there for 10 years to deposit players and athletes who were going to Lorenberg Institute. And so that's how we got there. And his father died shortly thereafter, and he went back for the funeral. And when he came back to Lorenberg, Frank and Sammy McDuffie, Mr. and Mrs. McDuffie said, if you don't want to go home, you don't ever have to go home again. This can be your home. Right. And that's how it was. And that's how Lefty Driesell found him, because Lefty would talk to McDuffie every year and say, you got any players who are smart enough to get into Davidson and good enough to play for me? And he said, I got one, maybe. So, and Charlie was staying during the summer instead of going back to New York like most of the guys. So that's how they got so close. And Charlie committed to Davidson after his junior year, and everybody thought he was going to Davidson.
But he didn't. I'm talking to Art Chansky today on The State of Things. He's written a book called Game Changers, Dean Smith, Charlie Scott, and the Era That Transformed the Southern College Town. He does come to UNC Chapel Hill. You suggested earlier that even though Dean Smith tried to make it a comfortable stay for him, it really wasn't.
No, it wasn't. How could it be when you think about it? Think about Chapel Hill and UNC. I mean, it wasn't a deep, deep South town. You know, there were liberal factions in the faculty. There were liberal factions in town. But it was still, there was a big battle over trying to pass a local public accommodations ordinance, and it never could pass. Yeah. There was a tremendous debate on it, and so Charlie found his social life at North Carolina Central, and he actually got married after his sophomore year because he was so lonely. He admits in the book that he got married for all the wrong reasons. He still feels terrible about it. Margaret Holmes was the woman's name. She's now living in Durham, and I think I'm the first and only person to ever interview her in the book, and Charlie needed it for loneliness. Because he didn't have, you know, he couldn't go with Rusty Clark to the Phi Delta House, and he couldn't go with Larry Miller to the Airing House to hang out with the football team because it was all white, and he was uncomfortable, and they were uncomfortable. So he founded an NC Central, and that helped him get through.
He did get through. His legacy, he's not gotten a lot of recognition over the years. I just have a minute left, but there's a reason for that, too. Right?
Well, Dean Smith, you know, funny, Dean Smith never wanted to recognize Charles Scott for being African-American. He wanted to recognize him for being a good student and a great basketball player, so he didn't want to make a big deal out of that. And I think UNC's made a mistake. You know, I think they haven't given him enough recognition, and I suspect that they're going to fix that.
How great a basketball player?
Frank, the greatest in the ACC back then, the only guy to play above the rim. He was the, you know, there were other black players in the ACC, but nobody like Charles Scott. And the fact that five voters left him off the first All-ACC team in 1969 was pure racism, clear racism, because Charlie Scott was far and away the best talent in the ACC.
Dean Smith, his legacy basketball runs deep, and do we know enough about his civil rights activity as well?
Yeah, we do. And, you know, this is a this book, the target for this book is our generation. There's no question about it, who lived through part or some of it and had heard about it. But it's also a tremendous gift for the millennials to give to their parents and grandparents, because I don't think kids really appreciate history now as much as we did. But this book is for their parents, and they should read it and also learn about what went on.
The book is called Game Changers, Dean Smith, Charlie Scott, and the Era That Transformed a College, Southern College Town. Art Chansky is the author. He reads at 3 o'clock Saturday at Barnes & Noble in Greensboro. Art, always a pleasure. Thank you so
much. Frank, thank you so much. It's great to be with you.
You can find out more at our website, stateofthings.org, and you can be on our program. Yeah, we'd love to talk with you about your favorite moment, your favorite segment on The State of Things. We're looking back. It's that time of year. And if there was a particular topic or conversation you found compelling, a State of Things driveway moment, you can email us at sot@wunc.org or hashtag SOT Moments. We need it by Friday, so if you can let us know by then, we'd be happy to have you on. State of Things is produced by Laura Lee, Anita Rao, Charlie Shelton Ormond, Katie Barron, and Laura Pelliser. Robin Copley's our technical director, Brent Wolf, WNC's news director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.